Hello and welcome to Science World. A canister containing samples of comet particles and space dust landed on Earth back in 2006. Since then, scientists analyzing the samples decided to take a very cautious approach in their studies. We'll explain why when we update their progress. Then, we've found another case of what's old is new again. Although a more modern vaccine to help stop the spread of the dreaded polio has been developed, scientists are now finding that the original polio vaccine that was developed back in the 1950s by Jonas Salk is still the best for reducing the spread of the paralytic disease. And you already know about the health benefits of keeping physically active. Now, scientists in Illinois who studied 9 and 10-year-old youngsters have found that the brain operates much more efficiently if you're aerobically fit. We'll talk with two of the research scientists today in our one-on-one segment. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Back in 1999, the U.S. Space Agency launched an unmanned craft named Stardust on a mission to capture particles from a comet and some interstellar space dust streaming through our galaxy. Roseanne Skirbel has a mission update.
The precious cargo was parachuted back to Earth in a canister in 2006 and recovered in the American Southwest. Scientific analysis of its contents determined the target comet contained rocks formed near the early sun. Now a study of the dust between the stars reveals these tiny rocks may come from beyond our solar system. University of California, Berkeley physicist Andrew Westfall is lead author. Writing in the journal Science, he says the interstellar sample has already yielded data impossible to gather from land or space-based telescopes.
The big surprise is that these particles are not all the same. They are each different from each other. And so we're getting our first glimpse into the diversity and complexity of interstellar dust on a particle-by-particle basis and within the particles themselves, which are really a complicated object.
The particles are tiny, more than 1,000 times smaller than a grain of sand.
More than 32,000 people have been participating in this project, and they've collectively done more than 100 million searches using a tool that was developed to run on a web browser.
The needle in a haystack search yielded some 100 thin-line tracks of suspected particles lodged in the aerogel and aluminum parts of the collector. The study reports on 7 of those particles that remained intact. Westfall and the 65 co-authors suggest those specks may be from outside our solar system, perhaps created in a supernova explosion millions of years ago and altered by exposure to the extreme space environment.
But there's more work to do, and one of the things that we need to do next on the particles, particularly in the aerogel, is to, it turns out, to measure the relative amounts of the three stable isotopes of oxygen. And that will really tell us about interstellar origin.
If these three different forms of oxygen do not match up, then Westfall says, it's probable they come from beyond our solar system. Westfall says the 7 grains are a small but important step in unraveling the mystery of how materials cycle through our galaxy.
As material condenses into stars and into solar systems, and then stars evolve and they synthesize new nuclei and new kinds of new atoms, which are then ejected back out into the interstellar medium to make a new generation of stars.
A process, Westfall says, has been going on since the galaxy's creation. In addition to this study, researchers are releasing another dozen articles in the journal Mediatrics and Planetary Science on the methods and techniques used to handle the fine grains of space dust. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
A newly released study has found that the first polio vaccine developed back in the 1950s is the best for curtailing the spread of this dreaded disease. Jessica Berman reports.
Despite a concerted global eradication effort for more than 25 years by the World Health Organization, national governments, and other groups, polio infection remains stubbornly persistent in a number of countries, including Pakistan, Nigeria, and Afghanistan. At one point, polio infected some 350,000 children per year worldwide. Anti-polio efforts have eliminated 99% of the cases. The goal is 100% eradication. The so-called Sabin vaccine, an oral medication developed by Albert Sabin, is made up of live weakened virus that effectively protects children against polio. While the Sabin vaccine is cheap and easy to administer, there are drawbacks. The vaccine loses its effectiveness over time, and it allows the virus to be shed in human waste to infect healthy children in endemic areas and across borders. Now, a new study has found the Salk vaccine, the first immunization drug developed against polio by Jonas Salk, offered better protection than a second booster dose of the oral medication in a trial in northern India. The Salk vaccine, which is administered by injection, uses inactivated virus to stimulate an immune response against polio. Its use dwindled in favor of the oral vaccine. In a telephone briefing with reporters, lead researcher Hamid Jafri, the director for polio operations and research with the World Health Organization, says the injectable Salk vaccine will now be used in place of the oral medication in regions where polio infection remains a public health problem.
It could play a major role in completing the job of polio eradication once and for all, both in the remaining endemic reservoirs and in specific outbreak settings, securing a polio-free world once and for all.
Polio has been eliminated in India, where a trial of the Salk vaccine was conducted in about 1,000 children who had been previously vaccinated with the oral vaccine. The research showed the Salk vaccine provided lasting intestinal immunity to prevent the shedding of virus through the digestive tract in infected children. The study is published in the journal Science. WHO Coordinator for Research and Product Development, Polio Operations and Research, Roland Sutter, says the findings end a long-running debate about the most effective strategy to eradicate polio.
The answer is now very clear. Both vaccines complement one another and should be used to interrupt the final chains of transmission to attain a polio-free world in the most rapid and effective way possible.
In addition, experts are recommending the Salk vaccine be given to travelers to prevent the international spread of polio in nations where it's been eradicated. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Speaking of the Salk polio vaccine, what we'd like to know for today's Science World Quick Quiz is, from the following, which university is the one where Jonas Salk developed his revolutionary vaccine? Was it A, Harvard University, B, the University of Arizona, C, Penn State University, or D, the University of Pittsburgh? Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Robots that can help us with daily chores like cooking and cleaning are a long way off, but automatons that serve as family companions may be much closer. Science World's Philip Alexio has this report by George Butich.
Several years after it was introduced to the world, the advanced Japanese humanoid robot, Asimo, is still serving only as a demonstration and experimentation platform. Even if available for purchase, it would be too expensive for ordinary families. It is much easier and cheaper to build a robot like Jibo, with simple movements and the ability to interact with people through sound, pictures, and touch. Massachusetts Institute of Technology researcher Cynthia Brazil created Jibo initially as a platform for exploring how people communicate with technology.
Jibo, as a robot, as something that can move with cameras that can see you and hear you and, again, interact with you much more like a living thing, so to speak, it can bring content to life off the screen in an entirely new way.
Jibo can remind you about appointments, take photos, entertain people, and tell stories to children. Brazil says it also incorporates touch-sensitive technology.
People often communicate through touch, right? So they might pat Jibo if it does something that they like, and Jibo can actually learn from that.
Therapists at Amici de Nico Autism Center in Lecce, Italy, use a small talking robot to treat autistic children. 11-year-old Marco shows great improvement in focusing and communication since he started playing with the robot that carefully keeps track of the child's behavior, says engineer Giuseppe Palestra. He says that they would like to be one step ahead of state-of-the-art so that they can make the human-robot interaction better and, let's say, humanize the interaction between the robot and the child. Researchers say they want to develop robots that can be programmed for individual patients because each child reacts differently to outside stimuli. French researcher Pierre Lebeau's family robot, Kiker, was designed as an entertainment platform that can follow its owner around.
I came with the idea of a computer with a projector inside and a great sound system and a camera, something that can move and go to any room to give me a kind of TV-like experience, but anywhere I want without the cables and the complexity.
Researchers say robots intended for entertainment might soon be on the market with prices ranging from about $500 to $5,000, still expensive for ordinary buyers. Therapeutic robots are still in experimental phase, but they, too, point to what we can expect from artificial intelligence in the near future. For writer George Pudich, I'm Philip Alexio.
Officials in Iceland think a volcano in their country is about to erupt. Science World's Doug Bernard has the story.
Intense seismic activity in Iceland has led officials there to believe a volcanic eruption is imminent. That's prompted them to issue warnings and evacuation orders for parts of the country. Iceland's Civil Protection Agency issued an evacuation order for an area north of the country's Bárðarbunga volcano. The move came after authorities this past Monday warned airlines about increased seismic activity at Iceland's largest volcanic system. London-based volcanologist Dr. Helen Thomas explains why concerns about an eruption are increasing.
At the moment, there's been increased amount of earthquakes beneath one of the volcanoes in Iceland. So from the 16th, the seismic activity has started to really increase. And these earthquakes are indicating that there's magma beneath the surface that's moving up towards the surface between about 1 and 10 kilometres. Now, if that magma reaches the surface and actually comes out of the ground, then that's when we get an eruption.
On Wednesday, around 1,000 earthquakes were detected in the Bárðarbunga region, the largest quakes measuring around 3 in magnitude. All roads leading into the area around the volcano were closed earlier in the week, and park rangers who lived there during the summer and tourists have been evacuated. Ash from the eruption of another Icelandic volcano in 2010 shut down much of Europe's airspace for 6 days. Authorities say the area is at high risk of being hit by floods as an eruption of the volcano, which is under a glacial ice cap in southeast Iceland, would melt vast amounts of ice. Icelandic officials have raised the risk level to the aviation industry for an eruption to orange, which is the fourth level on the 5-grade scale, after confirming magma movements less than 10 kilometers from the surface. The 2010 volcanic eruption that took place a little over 100 kilometers from the capital, Reykjavik, affected more than 10 million air travelers and cost $1.7 billion. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
While the Ebola epidemic continues to claim lives in West Africa, social media has been an ideal tool to educate the public about the deadly virus. George Pudich has more.
The World Health Organization says the current Ebola outbreak is the worst in history and will probably continue to spread for months through Western and Central Africa. Most of the cases have occurred in remote villages, where people rely mostly on radio and television for the news. In Ghana's capital, Accra, an announcer for the City 97.3 FM station reads the daily bulletin.
The deadly Ebola virus resurfaced in West Africa in February this year, Since then, it has claimed more than 700 lives.
The station's online manager, Mawuli Tsikata, says the government's campaign to raise awareness about HIV/AIDS was much more aggressive than education about Ebola.
In the case of Ebola, you don't see anything. You just depend on what the journalists report to the public. So I don't think the government is doing enough to educate the public about Ebola.
The epidemic has also reached large cities, where a more affluent population has access to computers, the internet, and social media. Blogger Jafet Omojua, based in Nigeria's capital Abuja, says social media users are often some of the most influential people in the society, so reaching them can help spread the word about the danger of Ebola.
They have access to those that are not on social media. So if they are interested, if they are made to know and understand the dangers and the risk of us not stopping Ebola from being a Nigerian issue, then they will likely get to reach their parents, their sisters, their cousins, their relatives.
Social media activism against the Ebola outbreak is not confined to individual bloggers. The Nigerian group Hexavia Logistics hopes its tweets are reaching many, not only in Nigeria, but other African countries as well. General Manager Babajide Fadoju says it is unfortunate that it took an epidemic for the African public to start talking about Ebola.
So the most important aspect of all things that we do is actually talking about it. Hence, talking about Ebola is actually one of the best things that has actually happened with the Ebola virus.
The World Health Organization says it will work with affected countries and their neighbors, renewing efforts to improve communication and teach people how to avoid infection and where to seek help. African bloggers and tweeters are already doing their part. George Putic, VOA News, Washington.
It's time to find out if you have the right answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Earlier, we asked from the following, at which university did Jonas Salk develop his revolutionary vaccine? Was it A, Harvard University, B, the University of Arizona, C, Penn State University, or D, the University of Pittsburgh? The answer is D, the University of Pittsburgh, which is located in western Pennsylvania. Dr. Salk was recruited by the school back in 1947 to establish the university's virus research lab, where his polio vaccine was developed. Human trials of the polio vaccine began in the Pittsburgh area in 1953 and then expanded to a national level a year later, becoming the largest controlled field trials in medical history. On April 12, 1955, the results of the human trials were announced to the world, with the vaccine being declared safe and effective. Jonas Salk died in California in 1995. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
For a number of years now, we've been hearing about the advantages keeping physically active provides. Now, a new study from researchers at the University of Illinois have found that the white brain matter of more aerobically fit 9- and 10-year-old youngsters have more fibrous and compact white matter tracts in their brains than those who are less active. What this means is that signals traveling between parts of the brain are being transmitted faster, and that the related nerve activity is much more efficient in the fit kids compared to those who aren't so physically active. Joining us today on our one-on-one segment to talk about their work are two members of the research team, Laura Chaddick-Hayman, a postdoctoral researcher at the university, and psychology professor and director of the university's Beckman Institute, Arthur Kramer. Laura, you study two groups of 9- and 10-year-olds. One group was made up of physically fit kids, while the other group were children who weren't so physically fit. What did you and your colleagues want to learn from this research?
We've known from previous work that The aerobically fit kids have outperformed the less aerobically fit children on a number of cognitive tasks that involve paying attention, remembering information. And so in the current study, we hope to understand what in the brain might be driving some of these differences. So we wanted to understand better what were the neural mechanisms, how we think of it, or the brain differences as a function of fitness in children.
With all the children you tested, did you have more in one group than the other?
Well, we've found over the years that it's tougher to get high-fit children these days in the United States.
I understand that what you studied was something called white brain matter. Now, I'm familiar with gray matter, but white brain matter is something different. What is this and what does it do?
So white matter tracks the axons of neurons that basically allow information to travel throughout the brain. So these white matter tracks connect all sorts of gray matter areas to integrate the brain into this structural network. So basically, these white matter fibers that we studied allow signals to communicate between these gray matter areas, so all the areas of the brain can communicate.
So your team looked at groups of kids, those who were physically active and those who weren't. So we're not necessarily talking about those who were or were not obese.
No, we weren't studying obesity here. That is a factor that we look at. The children in both groups were a little heavy, but certainly not obese, and that didn't differ as a function of these two groups.
Laura, what did you and your colleagues find after checking each group of children?
We found that the higher fit or the aerobically fit children had greater structural integrity of these white matter fibers compared to their lower fit peers, which suggests that perhaps these signals that allow these different gray matter areas to communicate via the white matter tracks, perhaps these signals travel more speedily, given that the white matter tracks of the higher fit kids were more structurally strong or compact or fibrous.
I understand that you and your team had studied older people in the past. Is the link between physical fitness and white matter integrity the same in other age groups?
Well, we find that older folks that are higher fit tend to have higher integrity white matter, which is a good thing because as we get older, we have less integrity in the white matter. We've also done something called randomized controlled trials or longitudinal studies with older folks and found that older folks who were involved in a walking program over 6 months and in some cases even over a year, 3 days a week, tended to have higher integrity in their white matter. With children, we're running a randomized controlled trial now in which children are either placed in a group in which they have go to an after-school program 2 hours a day in which they play lots of games that keep them moving, that are aerobic. And that's done for a school term, and we do that for several years to accrue enough children in that group and in a control group. That should be done in about 2 years.
Laura, let's talk a little bit about the research itself. How were you able to make these findings? How were your experiments conducted? How did you get the results?
We have quite a wonderful group of teammates. So we collaborate with a group of kinesiologists who help us recruit and get all these fitness information on all of these 9 and 10-year-olds. So we get the gold standard of aerobic fitness via a treadmill test in which the children have to walk or run on a treadmill, and we can measure the expired gases, like the oxygen and carbon dioxide, that these children are breathing in and breathing out. And from this information, we can basically calculate the aerobic peak of these children. And so that was a nice way for us to classify the children as higher fit or lower fit. And then at the Beckman Institute, we got an MRI on each one of the children and were able to look at, with a special type of MRI scan called diffusion tensor imaging, we were able to image these white matter fibers in all the children and then compare how the structural integrity of these white matter fibers in the higher fit and lower fit children.
I'm curious, if the children in your non-physically fit group took the steps necessary to become physically fit, would the integrity of their white matter improve?
That's certainly the hypothesis, and that is what has been found in some studies with older adults.
That was Laura Chaddick-Hayman, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Illinois and psychology professor and also director of the Beckman Institute, Arthur Kramer. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.